Hi, this is Growing Up Aspen with Andy Collin and Chris Pomeroy, and today we're here interviewing Adam Kane, who I was yearbook photographer all the way to Hollywood cinematographer, producer, director. He's done a lot of films, Boondock Saints, he's worked on American Gods, the TV show, and he's here with us today. So yeah, here is Adam Kane. And it's interesting, it segues into a thing that I've been, because I worked at the Technifilm Labs back here in Portland, which every filmmaker or anybody who was doing film, it was the one lab you could go to. And so when Gus Van Sant was in town and doing his films and stuff, it was interesting because he used his friends for like the first couple films, you know, A Drugstore Cowboy, My Own Private Idaho, To Die For, I think were all his friends. So the cinematographer, everybody were his friends, and it was a different feel. Once he went to Good Will Hunting, it was a different deal. The studios were more, a little bit more like, you can't, I mean, Psycho was pretty much the last one where he used his old crew. And you could see that there was sort of an independent, crisp edge to those earlier films. And as a cinematographer, and as a director person coming through all that, do you have an idea of like how, I mean, I feel like the industry forces people once you get big to go into a certain foot that they want you to do. And staying independent is also sort of an interesting thing that everybody wants to do. So there's this pull about getting into the industry, but also being independent. And then as a cinematographer, you're involved with the look and feel of the film. And I felt like that was something that was so important. And I felt like Gus has always been trying to get back. Whereas I felt like it's just the old dudes. It's the old guys that you used to hang out with. That is missing. And when you don't have that, So do you have, can you have an insight as a cinematographer kind of coming in and then also running your own sort of setup? Because that's a little different too. I mean, that's a whole nother beast.
A lot of it has to do with expectations, because, you know, in the commercial world, as you, I'm sure you both know, especially you, Andy, you know, when the client's paying, they have expectations, and that's all mitigated by the market. So in the independent film market, there was a lot more room to experiment, as you're suggesting,
yeah,
with Gus Van Sant and his approach to filmmaking, and people like him, like Steven Soderbergh, also falls into that same category. And there's many filmmakers you could talk about, Chris Nolan. But I started in independent filmmaking when I was a cinematographer as well. And every film was its own adventure, which is to say, there were a group of low budget independent producers who would make movies specifically for what they call the genre markets. Uh-huh. This includes action films, horror films, you know, thrillers,
art,
so on and so forth. And so if you were making a movie that you wanted to like do an art piece version of a horror film, that wasn't going to go over very well with a producer who is expecting to have sort of a cookie cutter, like paint by numbers version, because that's how they made their money.
Right.
And if they couldn't make their money because they weren't giving their buyers the expected delivery, then, you know, that was a problem. And in that market, being able to be a bit of a chameleon was important.
Yeah.
So a lot of people like me, like when I started out as a cinematographer, when I finally did get back to Los Angeles, I shot anything that would come my way. I shot weddings. I shot bank depositions for the courts,
right,
when there was financial fraud, which, as you might imagine, is incredibly dry and horrible. I shot every short film I was offered, because short films are great. Like, that was a medium where you could literally experiment and do anything you want, right? Because the expectation was to stand out. You wanted it to be different.
Right.
So if you wanted to make it extra contrasty or extra grainy or whatever, like, that was a value add, you know, because you weren't trying to fit it into a commercial box.
Right.
I shot news for the Associated Press, covered the OJ trial in 1994, 95, whenever that was.
Yeah.
I covered the Oklahoma City bombing in Oklahoma City as a news photographer. So, like, those are all, like, incredible experience, like all of them, the weddings, the bar mitzvahs, they all contributed to my language as a storyteller.
Uh-huh.
Because when you're doing live events like weddings or a tragedy at a crime scene, you actually don't know what the story is. You have no idea what the story is.
Right.
You're putting the pieces together in real time, and your job is to do it quickly and efficiently to give the editor enough visual pieces to be able to tell a story to an audience and then rush it and get it on air before the other guy does. And that, for working in today's market, when everybody wants you to do things for faster and cheaper,
yeah,
that's incredibly valuable. People are paid and valued for their speed, their demeanor, not panicking, things like that. And to be able to, like, deliver really high quality stuff and be facile with it. So everything helps, no matter what. But there was this sort of, you know, box that you got put in that time, where if I was doing mostly independent films, which I was an indie film guy. In other words, I wasn't a TV guy and I wasn't a feature guy.
Right.
So I wasn't considered for those projects.
Right.
Now, in my naivete and in coming from, you know, like my childhood and growing up in Aspen, where if you wanted to do something, you just sort of like talk to a bunch of people and you got it done.
Yeah, exactly. You know?
It's like, oh, we want to put on a concert? Cool. Can we get the stage at the school? Yeah, let's go talk to somebody. You just, you know, you made it happen. Or, yeah, my dad knows somebody at the Jerome. Maybe we could, like, get it on a Sunday night when it's quiet. Or, you know, you just figured it out, right?
We built a BMX track and this got the city dump, the city bulldozers.
I remember that.
Track behind ISIS.
Totally.
Yeah, behind the Island Park.
I mean, so I had the same sort of, and again, like, if I'd grown up in Los Angeles, I don't know if I would have had that.
Right.
Because you can't get away with that stuff in a bigger city.
Yeah.
It's just, you don't have the leeway. People are going to say no. People are going to want money. People aren't going to want some kid, you know, hanging around.
Or a permit or whatever, yeah.
It almost feels like that was more like the pool, empty pool, skateboard film making. I mean, you know, that was the only opportunity in that kind of a setting, in a sense. You know?
Yeah, it was a Tony Hawk era for sure. Like,
right.
You know, that was the rebellion. And it, there was, you know, all things being equal, there was money to be made at the end of that rainbow with skateboarding. You could become sponsored like Tony Hawk. You could become a professional surfer and get sponsored. So those kinds of things were kind of looked at, even though nobody would admit it, at possible careers, you
right.
know?
Right.
Even though most of the parents would be like, who is it? Kelly Slater was the famous surfer from the West Coast. That
Right. And then there's
a breakout. He was like the Tony Hawk of the surf world. You know?
Yeah. Yeah.
So, you know, with like when I started as a cinematographer, I just, you know, did whatever I thought was right. And I hit a lot of brick walls. But, you know, people were generally pretty kind to me. Like at one point, there was a listing in the Hollywood Reporter for a movie that was being made by a filmmaker named Mike Figgis in the UK.
Yeah.
It was, you know, like a pretty big deal. I didn't know who he was. I just saw this thing. They needed a cinematographer. So I wrote a letter with my resume, you know, and I sent it in. And I got, I still have it. It was very kind from Paramount UK on their letterhead.
Yeah.
A rejection letter. You know,
yeah.
You know, thank you for inquiring. Mr. Figgis has chosen a director of photography, but will keep your resume on file. And I thought, you know what? How classy is that? Like, how kind is that? You know, that's a level of mentorship that I learned in Aspen that I have since seen evaporate largely in the landscape of the world, which is sad to me.
Yeah, I agree 100%. I did this similar thing. I sent a cover. I did a sculptor, clay sculptor cover for Time Magazine, took a picture, cut out the whole thing, put it together, made it look like a real cover, sent it into Time Magazine. And they wrote back and they said, well, we can't, it's a little too controversial for us to use, but we pass it around and everybody laughed and everybody loved it. And they sent me back that letter. So in a way it was a rejection letter, but it was also a keep going kind of thing.
An affirmation letter. Yeah.
You know, it's funny. I think you hit on a vein there that, I could be wrong, but I think one of the things about Aspen that is so unique about us growing up there is that we don't stop and say, that'll never happen, so I'm not even going to try. So you sending that in to that director, Andy sending that into Time Magazine, I've got similar stories, you know, in loser letters that come back and they're like, you know, the best one I got was from Adult Swim it says, sorry, you know, we had 8,000 people apply, you know, good luck with your career or whatever. Here is a free t-shirt. And they sent me a t-shirt. But most people never in their dreams would think about even trying that. You see what I'm saying? And I think that the three of us have that in common, or Lo and Dean and everybody else.
I think it's sort of a natural thing. I mean, when you have the solos, you're on your own. And yeah. I think when you grow up in a world where everybody's like, hey, you could do this, you could be a skier, you could do that, you could do those bumps, you could do this, you kind of grow up thinking that there no isn't an answer. It's more of a challenge.
Right.
And folks who take it as a challenge advance, whereas other folks kind of get stuck in like, well, I've had kids try to get a job for me. I'm a character designer. And I'm like, okay, what happens after the 2 weeks of character design is over? You know, I don't know if I want to hire someone for the whole project, not just someone for 2 weeks, you know?
I guess what I'm getting at, Andy, is that I think all three of us have something in common. And that is that if you think of something, you shoot right to the top. And you say, what have I got to lose? Okay. My wife will give me crap about it all the time. She'll be like, what makes you think the governor is going to respond to your letter or something? You know, like that. Yeah, it's right. Like, yeah, well, I've never even thought not to try, you know?
Right.
Yeah. I don't know if it's a generational thing or if it's an Aspen thing. Maybe it's a bit of both. But I agree with you, Chris. I think that you know, I kind of came into my adult self with this idea that life was like the lottery. If you don't play, you can't win.
Yeah.
And one of my common phrases that I tell my own kids or anybody else that is willing to listen is that the answer is already no, if you don't even ask.
Yeah.
So why not ask? Because you don't ask if you don't get. And in most things in life, it's not brain surgery. It's not that there's too many people doing it. They have to pick somebody. So right. Why not me? And but I got to put myself out there or else I'm not even going to be a known quantity.
Yeah, exactly. And then like in art school, when we would do a drawing, people would say like, how did you get such an awesome drawing? You know, and be like, well, I threw out probably 35 that failed, you know?
It's the 10,000.
So, yeah, you're not going to get an answer every time. But yeah. To your point, you can never win or lose if you don't run the race. You know, it's just that's the way it is.
And I still believe that.
When I remember doing working on a film with my wife, and we would one of it was we just each took different shots, different scenes, and we'd help each other shoot it. And one shot that I had three different levels of animation. So on top of the platen that pushed the artwork down, I would animate with sawdust, and then I'd animate three other layers, the background and other animated stuff behind. And so that shot took like 15 hours just for that one shot, and it was only 20 seconds, maybe less. And we shot that 4 times. Now, not a lot of people would sit there and go, oh, screwed up. Okay, I'm never going to be able to get all that stuff lined up and working right, you know. But it's the person who has that keeps going on. I mean, a lot of what old school animation used to be is you didn't have undos. It was all into film. It was all under the camera. you had to reshoot the whole darn thing all over again. It wasn't like you could go back a couple stages and then go backwards. You know, you had to just go all the way through and then redo it again all the way through. And I feel like when you do that, you get used to the process of it, you know? And I feel like now some That's of the right. technology has kind of changed some of that. And being our age, where we have our foot in old and tradition and technical, you know, we kind of, it's a very interesting step to be in. Do you know what I mean? And part of who you are and what keeps you going is the fact that you actually had your foot in that step. You know what I mean? And I feel like it's interesting in today's world for kids because they don't really teach that old stuff as much.
But
not at all.
Thanks for listening. The authors of Growing Up Aspen would like to thank you and would like to also thank the Aspen Times and the Aspen Daily News for giving us materials for our book, Growing Up Aspen, Adventures of the Unsupervised, which you can get at twistandturnpress.com and any local bookstore. Thanks.